and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station all around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
We're witnessing very, very unusual times in terms of politics and how governments respond to this extraordinary threat that we all face. And to have the Prime Minister laid low at somebody who is, as you say, very popular will certainly be very concerning for Britain.
The worrying news that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved into intensive care has brought home again the seriousness of the threat that we face against coronavirus. Also on the program...
So if you're giving everyone an adjustment, it makes no difference. You may as well give nothing because, you're just inflating everyone equally is not going to necessarily help anyone.
Coronavirus is affecting all people across the country, but those attempting Year 12 are very much concerned about how their ATAR is going to affect them and their chances of getting into university. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. The case against former Cardinal George Pell took a final turn today as the High Court released its judgment overturning the Victorian Court of Appeal decision. George Pell has had his convictions quashed and was released from jail earlier today. I asked Dr. Andrew Dyer, Deputy Director, Sydney Institute of Criminology at the University of Sydney's Law School, why the High Court came to this decision.
I think that the court has made this decision essentially because of the inability of the DPP in the High Court to defend these allegations in a way that was particularly plausible. And that said, there were too much evidence pointing in the opposite way to the complainant's evidence. And so there were three items of evidence that their honours in the High Court attached particular significance to. One was George Pell's practice of standing on the steps outside the cathedral after Mass. The second was George Pell's practice, said to be invariable by many witnesses, of being in the company of somebody while he was in the cathedral. And the third piece of evidence that was pretty crucial here was the fact that the sacristy where Pell was said to have offended was a hive of activity on the accounts of many witnesses. It was said to be a hive of activity after Mass. Now, these witnesses gave this evidence about Pell's having been on the steps and about his always being in company and about the fact that this sacristy would have been attended by a number of people, would have been occupied by a number of people at the time of the alleged offending, and it wasn't really challenged at the trial by the Crown. And so in those circumstances, their honours found that there was a reasonable doubt as to Pell's innocence. There was a significant possibility, they said, that an innocent person had been convicted, even despite the compelling evidence of the complainant that Pell did offend in the ways in which the complainant said he did.
So originally this was a jury trial, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a jury trial before the Chief Judge of the County Court of Victoria, Judge Kidd.
So from a legal point of view, when you're running a trial before a jury, you would, I guess, emphasise the evidence, the very emotive evidence of the witness in this case. And perhaps you wouldn't be then necessarily wanting to bring in too much of the technical aspects that perhaps on appeal are more important. Would I be correct in saying that?
Well, I suppose that's right. I suppose you'd have to say that the thing that was helping the Crown here was that the complainant gave this evidence of Pell's having offended both in the sacristy on one occasion and outside the sacristy on another occasion. Now, this guy gave evidence that was found by the majority in the Court of Appeal to have been compelling, and obviously the jury found it to be so. However, I suppose when you have a number of witnesses giving this evidence that Pell would have been on the steps, would have been in company, that the sacristy would have been attended. And I might add, there are a couple of witnesses who claim to have had a specific recollection of having been with Pell on the occasion on which the first incident occurred. And there were two dates when it might have occurred. There was this evidence that these guys remembered Pell's having been on the steps on those times. When you've got that evidence, what the High Court is saying is that it is really incumbent upon the prosecution to challenge the witnesses who give that evidence. And if there is no proper challenge to it, then despite the fact that you've got this compelling testimony from the complainant, there is a reasonable doubt as to guilt. Now, that doesn't mean
because
that
the
Pell
times don't
definitely
match up.
Didn't do it.
It's because the times don't match up, isn't it? I mean, how can you be in two places at once? This is what they're saying.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. Yeah, well, and what the defence was saying on appeal was, well, hang on, that 5 to 6 minutes was said to be the 5 to 6 minutes of offending, and yet it occurred directly after Mass when Pell would have been going back to the sacristy. So 3 or 4 of those 5 or 6 minutes would have been taken up by him actually getting back to the sacristy. So, yeah, that was one of the submissions that was made, and it pretty much found favour in the High Court.
So is this a good judgment then?
In my opinion, having read it, it's a reasonably solid judgment, yes. I sat through both days in the High Court. I was in the public gallery both of those days. And by the end of the proceedings, I was thinking, well, I don't really think that the prosecution has explained why these convictions are sound. Now, that's not saying that there is no possibility that George Pell did what he was alleged to have done. All it's saying is that I think the jury should have had a doubt in this case, essentially for the reasons that were given by the High Court bench.
Is that meaning this particular episode is over?
Yeah, that's right. These matters can't be re-agitated. The High Court is the final court of appeal, and so there is no prospect that these matters will come before the courts again.
Dr. Andrew Dyer, Deputy Director, Sydney Institute of Criminology, the University of Sydney's Law School, with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. With the coronavirus pandemic causing the world to work from home, there's been a major influx towards video calling apps, and with that, there's an increased risk of cybersecurity breaches and hacking. One of the most popular video conferencing apps is Zoom, with over 200 million daily users due to its user-friendly and easy-to-access features. However, it's been found that Zoom has a lack of transparency and there have been privacy breaches. Patty Burton has more.
Last week, the chief executive of Zoom, Eric Yuan, made a statement responding to the wide range of criticism the company has received during the coronavirus pandemic. This included sending user data to Facebook and a phenomenon named Zoom bombing, which allowed uninvited users to gatecrash meeting calls and conferences, with some cases of pornographic imagery and racist remarks being shown. Professor Matthew Warren, Deputy Director of the Deakin University Centre for Cybersecurity, says Zoom has a two-pronged issue.
In terms of the Zoom technology, where the problems have come from is they've found instances of where there is malware installed with some of the Zoom installers. The other problem that Zoom has is their statement around their encryption is that they haven't got particularly strong encryption. They're using weaker encryption. And the other problem is they're saying that it's end-to-end encryption. So, you know, you're encrypted on your computer and the person at the other end is encrypted and data is encrypted. And that doesn't seem to be the case. Whereas some of the other software like WebEx and Skype have point-to-point encryption. The other concern is about that some of those encryption keys are actually coming from China. So some of the technology that Zoom is using is actually linked to China, and those China servers are releasing the encryption keys, which means data's being held on Chinese servers, which may be, you know, accessible, you know, from the Chinese authorities. And this is the reason why in the UK and also in Australia, they've issued warning regarding, you know, the use of Zoom for, you know, for sensitive meetings.
That's the problem with the technology, but there's also the problem with how it's being used.
The problem with Zoom is all the defaults for, like, your meetings are set is open. So it means that when people set up a Zoom meeting and they haven't put in the password protection, anyone with that that Zoom meeting number can join it. The other problem you have is when someone joins your Zoom meeting, their email address and their profile pictures, you've then had the problem with Zoom and the Facebook issue. So what happened with Zoom is one of the things that they allow is for you to authenticate into Zoom using your Facebook credentials. So it's called a federated login. But what happened with their Apple app for Zoom was it was then sharing when people logged into Facebook on their Apple phone to use Zoom, it was then sharing all this, you know, information about users with Facebook as part of that sort of login process. So that became like a privacy issue.
Zoom Chief Executive Eric Yuan stated that they did not design the product with the foresight of everyone working from home. I asked Professor Matthew Warren if he thought this was a reasonable excuse or should these issues have been at the forefront of the design process.
It should have been at the forefront. There's a concept called security by design, and that concept is it doesn't matter whatever system you're developing. At the development stage, the security considerations are built into the system. So I think that Zoom, you know, just trying to make up a bit of an excuse on why they shouldn't have done things properly before.
With these types of apps keeping the world connected during the pandemic, there are many consequences.
I think, you know, it's going to become the new normal. And because it's going to become the new normal, it means that cyber criminals, you know, are going to, you know, try to exploit those systems. So as we've seen with Zoom, you know, there's a whole range of issues that actually relate to the application and also how people, you know, use it. It's really trying to change people's behavior and culture. But because this is a completely new system, people are still learning how to use it. They're still learning, you know, how to enable, you know, the security features. And Zoom, the company, are now realizing, you know, that there's now all these security issues and challenges that they need to resolve in order for it to be used ongoing into the future.
Professor Matthew Warren from Deakin University there, speaking with Paddy Burton. We woke this morning to find that the health of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has taken a turn for the worse and he's now in intensive care. In the UK, there is no Deputy Prime Minister as we have here in Australia, and usually the Foreign Secretary would deputise if the PM was incapacitated. I asked Emeritus Professor Clement McIntyre of the University of Adelaide whether Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab was effectively in control of the United Kingdom.
Yes, effectively, with the Prime Minister isolated and incapacitated as he is in intensive care, then the burden of leadership passes to Dominic Raab, who is both the Foreign Secretary, the equivalent of our Foreign Minister here in Australia, but he also has a title called First Secretary of State, which effectively means he is deputy to Boris Johnson. The UK doesn't really have a deputy prime minister. They have appointed those people to that post from time to time, but it's not common. And normally somebody with a title First Secretary of State is deemed by the system to be the deputy to all intents and purposes. And it's clear that Johnson has handed responsibility to Raab while he's in intensive care. And so Dominic Raab is, to all intents and purposes, acting prime minister.
It's pretty serious. Has there ever been a Prime Minister that's had to step back from office in this way?
I can't think of anyone who's been incapacitated to the extent that Johnson clearly is now in intensive care. There have been Prime Ministers who have had serious health scares in the past. Winston Churchill, of course, had a stroke while he was Prime Minister. Harold Macmillan in the early 60s resigned because... that I can't think of any case in recent history where somebody has been effectively removed from office by the extent of their illness.
What are the mechanics involved here? Is it easy for Dominic Raab to take the reins?
Well, relatively. I think we've got to remember that Johnson was first laid low with this virus about 10 days ago and was in self-isolation. So there's no doubt that Downing Street would have been putting some plans in place in case the worst thing happened, which it has. And Raab would have known that it would fall to him. So the system would be coping with that quite well. He will just step into the Prime Minister's seat when it comes to sort of chairing meetings and making the final decisions and so on.
He like? Is he a safe pair of hands?
Relatively, I think. Johnson obviously seems to have appointed him to the post that he has. He's got relatively limited cabinet experience. He served as the Brexit secretary under Theresa May for about 4 months before resigning. He was a very strong Brexiteer. When Theresa May resigned the leadership, he was one of those Conservatives who nominated for the leadership, but he didn't get very far through the election process and was a Johnson loyalist as soon as he dropped out of that contest. So he can work very well with Johnson. There are members of the cabinet who've got greater experience of sitting around the table, you know, longer terms in office. But all the indications are that he's someone that the system will work with. You know, his colleagues in Downing Street will be able to work with for some time.
Boris Johnson is one of the world leaders that got the most bounce in the polls when this crisis started. What is it going to do to the psyche of the general population? They must be worried.
Oh, no doubt at all about that. I think politics will change in Britain as a result. The dynamic of the political debates, we've got to remember there's a brand new leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, who's just been elected as Leader of Labour. He's still really putting together his front bench team, but he's already signalled that he'll support the government in a number of non-partisan areas, but he'll be critical when he sees problems with government policy. I don't expect we'll see a lot of that in the next few days. I think everyone will be watching Johnson very carefully. And all of the wishes that are coming from political leaders from all sides of politics in Britain are universally wishing him well and hoping that he can get back into office very quickly. But we're witnessing very, very unusual times in terms of politics and how governments respond to this extraordinary threat that we all face. And to have the Prime Minister laid low and somebody who is, as you say, very popular, just won a commanding election victory a matter of months ago, will certainly be very concerning for Britain, and everyone will be wanting to see Johnson recover as quickly as possible.
Is it really something that is going to really make people realise how serious this coronavirus is?
Yes, I've no doubt about that. Britain is seeing deaths at 500-600 people a day, and they're pretty grim headlines. And I think everybody is aware how dangerous the virus is, and any complacency is probably long gone. But seeing a very public figure, we've seen Prince Charles self-isolate after a positive test, but seeing the Prime Minister not just have a positive test, but succumb to the illness in the way that he has and require intensive care will really force to people, I think. Everybody is at risk from this virus, and the importance of social isolation and hand-washing and all of the protocols that governments are encouraging.
Emeritus Professor of Politics Clement McIntyre speaking with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. On Monday, the Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews floated the possibility of extending Year 12 into next year as a result of the coronavirus's effects on schooling. The potential extension has raised many questions about how the virus may affect ATAR results and admissions processes for prospective students. To find out more, Ryan Stanton asked Kim Paino, General Manager of Marketing and Engagement at the University Admissions Centre, about where the situation currently stands.
The current situation is that in New South Wales, we are very committed to maintaining as much of a normal situation this year as ever. Obviously, it's very different in lots of ways, but in terms of completing Year 12, sitting their HSC, getting an HSC, getting an ATAR, going into uni, all of us in the background, and that's UAC and NESA and the universities, remain committed to keeping that in place as much as we are able.
There's been changes to some assessments for these Year 11, 12 subjects, even as exams are meant to go ahead as normal. How will this affect the AHSC ATAR marks and admissions process?
If we're proceeding on the assumption that exams are going to still take place, then a lot of what we do will remain relatively unchanged.
The Victorian Premier has floated the possibility of extending Year 12 into next year, and others have called for a sort of blanket bump to ATARs or the abolishment of it altogether as a solution. How is the UAC and universities dealing with the effect this may have on admissions?
Yeah, look, there's so many options, aren't there? But what we're trying to do is minimise the disruption as much as possible. Some of these suggestions, I think, are really troubling for students. It's pretty unhelpful because they've been on a track for some time now, let's face it, to finish this year and to sort of then start thinking about, gosh, do we still have to keep going next year? I feel like these are worst-case scenarios. Having said that, for university admission, we've got a bit of wriggle room, I suppose. If exams in New South Wales are delayed a bit, then we can still cope and still have students getting off to uni and enrolling to start uni end of February next year.
In terms of the worst case scenarios, I'm wondering, does this affect all students equally?
So there's no point giving just a general, we'll give every student a COVID-19 adjustment this year because they've all suffered. Because from a university entry point of view, it's a ranking. So if you're giving everyone an adjustment, it makes no difference. You may as well give nothing because, it, you know, just inflating everyone equally is not going to necessarily help anyone. What you need to do is identify where there might have been particular pockets of extreme disadvantage or extra disadvantage. So I'm thinking immediately of students who haven't got the technology at home to do remote learning or their school hasn't had the resources to really get it up and running quickly. I know, you know, just talking to people, some schools are straight onto it and they're doing lessons and have been for the last week or so pretty successfully, and others less so because there's resource issues and technology issues. So how can we look at that picture and make sure that we're compensating those students who've suffered particularly through this?
Should we expect to see a blanket solution to this problem, or will there be variation in the ways that this is solved at a state, school or university level?
Look, we do have a state-based system and that it is there now, and we already have had many years of coping with states doing things their own way but also having some national consistency. And that's where we've got something like the ATAR, which is portable across states, even though each state is responsible for calculating it. And not only that, each state does it a little bit differently. So I think some things will have local differences, I guess, and we've already seen different statements coming out of other states around what they might or might not be doing for Year 12s this year. I think broadly it would be fantastic if we got agreement on some key principles. Whether that's attainable, I don't really know. We hope that that will be, because you want things to be equitable for as many students as humanly possible.
Kim Paino, General Manager of Marketing and Engagement at the University Admissions Centre, speaking with Ryan Stanton. That's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or listen to our podcast. Just search for The Wire. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for The Wire Radio, all one word. Wire is a team effort from 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or even online weekdays. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney and produced in Sydney on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay safe and thanks for your company.
bringing you stories and music from across the nation.
See you long.